You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 8th of September 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. Also ahead on the program, we'll head to New York to talk to Mario Garcia, founder of the newspaper design giant Garcia Media, to hear his take on modern media.
I believe that kids who are in kindergarten and junior high school today are going to crave for moments of disconnect, and print provides that.
And we also jump over to Portland, Oregon, to hear from the editor of Kinfolk magazine about fine dining and small gatherings.
The premise behind the magazine is that it is actually cool and quite enjoyable to stay at home and, you know, make your own meal, invite people over and entertain.
All that and a little bit more on edition 2 of The Stack. Hello and welcome to edition 2 of The Stack here on Monocle 24, our weekly review of the best and not so good in print media. Today we'll be looking at The Niche, a sound redesign, and a curatorial fetish fanzine. But before that, time to meet our guests. And as ever on The Stack, we have two experienced yet still enthusiastic stalwarts of the print world joining us here in Studio One. Zed Nelson is an old friend of Monocle. He's also an old friend of mine whose stunning photography has graced the pages of many an expo. He's reported from South Sudan to Afghanistan, where we spent a bit of time together, and pretty much everywhere else in between. But in his latest book, Love Me, Zed changes tack somewhat, reflecting on the cultural and commercial forces that drive global obsession with youth and beauty. Zed, welcome. What does that look like in print or digital form?
What, the book, the project?
Yes.
Well, it's a hardback photography book, and I went to 17 different countries, and it's an investigation into the sort of human need to be loved, about how commercial forces have really monopolized on making us incredibly insecure as a way of extracting money out of us.
And is it an indictment in every country that you end up in?
No, I mean, it really is about how needy we are and how kind of easily manipulated we can be if we allow ourselves. So it's a kind of warning cry. And some of it's gentler, and I'm not trying to, sort of show any one country as being worse than any other, but it's more just about how globalization has had this kind of effect on us psychologically.
And it's not going to land you a L'Oreal campaign anytime soon. or we never know.
You never know. Still hoping.
Also in this studio, we are joined by Jane Morris, the editor of the art newspaper, the Italian-owned organ of the art world, that's as well known for wondering aloud who bought what at Art Basel as it is for discussing the politics of restoration and of the slew of new world museums. A fixture in the luggage of the world's art collectors, the art newspaper also gets down to serious business at the world's leading art fairs. Jane edits daily versions during Art Basel, its Miami brother, and Frieze, which perhaps means looking at rather a different stack of paper in front of her of a weekend. Welcome.
Hello.
You've got an enormous volume of titles that we're going to look at today, but I want to talk very, very briefly just before we started. You're learning how to ride a bike in London, and I'm wondering if that's going to perhaps force some stories on urbanism and what needs to be done in cities as well.
I think having spent some of my summer trying to tackle some of the roundabouts and big junctions in London, I think that there's a great deal we could do to improve the layout of roads to help cyclists. It's been quite a shock. It's quite enervating.
Now, is this, we're not too far away from the kickoff of Frieze. In fact, I was running around Regent's Park this morning and could see that it looks like, you know, construction work is already about to start. I mean, what happens in terms of, is it three big cycles for you, but also because you know, you've got dailies when you're doing these events? Is summer, in fact, really a slow period, you know, in your sector of the newsstand?
Yeah, the art world, I wouldn't say it goes to sleep in July and August, because actually it's a time when a lot of people, curators and so forth, will actually get some space to think about the exhibitions that they might want to do in a year or so's time. But in terms of the market, the collectors all disappear off to wherever collectors go, the Bahamas and lovely places like that. And most of the art world spends its time regrouping, whether you're a curator or an art dealer or I'll just go on holiday like everybody else. Mm.
Now, you both have collected a bit of a stack in front of you. Zed, we're going to talk about one title, Kinfolk, which I know you have off to the side. We have a small package about them. But what else do you have today, just to tease our listeners? What else are we going to look at?
Well, as a photographer, I kind of can't help but bring to my choices magazines that kind of interest me photographically or use images well or badly or whatever. So I've got a French magazine called C'est Moi, which is a sort of very thick Bible of a magazine. It comes out twice yearly. And they run 25-page photo essays or stories. So that's just incredible in its own right. But I also want to talk about, I've got some niche magazines which are very specific to different subjects. And I want to talk about how if it's done well enough, I could find myself interested in any subject. There's one on soccer. I'm not in the least bit interested in football, but it's a sort of really well-produced magazine, and you can't help picking it up and leafing through it. So there's a number of magazines I want to talk about in that sort of
genre. Jane, are you going to get niche on us today as well?
I am also very niche because I've brought a lot of magazines relating to the art world. I think in the same way that you're very interested in photography, I'm very interested in how we gather and analyse information. So I've brought some of the key sources of information in the art world, which probably only a few people read in many cases, but for us are often sources of stories or things that we might want to develop.
Great. Well, on the topic of niche, Kinfolk is a magazine that appreciates and celebrates the small, informal and spontaneous art of entertaining. It's conceived by a group of artists and writers based across North America, from Portland, Oregon to San Francisco, Los Angeles to Michigan and my hometown of Winnipeg. Kinfolk is a food magazine about people. Kinfolk is about gatherings, the meeting of minds around the table and rituals that surround eating rather than big blowout meals and complex culinary feasts. The format is simple. Portraits of cooks, servers and store cupboards sit next to lyrical text and classic recipes. So far, the team has published 4 volumes and also set up a network of suppers to take advantage of the rich community that already exists around them. We caught up with the editor of Kinfolk, Nathan Williams.
It's an entertaining magazine, focusing a lot more on the reasons that we entertain and spend time together, eating and cooking. So the people, the traditions, the more the social elements. Growing up with my family as well, that was kind of how we spent our weekends. And with friends as well, we kind of had to get really creative up there with the things that we could do to kind of entertain ourselves as friends. So the magazine kind of came out of that, as well as just some conversations with friends while we were in school, just talking about how there's a lot of magazines, publications out there, but there was nothing that kind of resonated for us as far as entertaining and inspiration on things that we could do on the weekends, other than just the traditional clubs, bars, the things that are stereotyped for our generation. The premise behind the magazine is that it is actually cool and quite enjoyable to stay at home and, you know, make your own meal, invite people over and entertain.
Where do you see Kinfolk as fitting in the media landscape?
It's published independently. We do it ourselves, and we really do focus on making sure that it feels like a novelty, like something special, something you'd actually go out and buy yourself as a gift, versus a magazine that you might just pick up for a quick read on the bus. So this is something that's collectible. It's something that you display on your coffee table and is timeless. You wouldn't necessarily toss it out after a month. At least that's our hope. We do want it to look nice. I mean, we want it to be kind of an appealing lifestyle, like something that anyone that cares about products that are designed well, that is something that they'd appreciate. So all of the imagery, I mean, it's meticulous, the way that the typography is designed, everything is, we try and make sure that it's consistent so that it can be appreciated in that way.
Who's your audience? Who are you aiming at, Lisa?
Our contributing team, we have about 60 photographers and writers that contribute to each issue, and they're spread across the map. So here in the States, in Germany, and Finland, and then it's also distributed worldwide as well. So we have it here in the States as well as throughout the UK, a lot of readers in Australia and also Japan. It's a concept that I think is easy to relate to. I mean, a lot of us enjoy food, of course, spending time with friends, for sure. So it's something that feels familiar.
When did you come up with the idea for Kinfolk?
Started working on it last July of 2011. We just released our 4th issue. The 5th will come out next month. So it's a young publication. We're all just kind of rolling with the punches and learning as we go.
What's the feedback been like?
It's been great. I mean, that's been one of the biggest surprises, I guess, as we've worked on it, is how responsive the readers can be. As we send this out, we get a lot of emails of people liking articles, critiquing articles, even minor changes like we switched the cover stock slightly. And we got emails of people approving, people disapproving. And because we have such a small team working on the magazine, we're nimble and we're able to adjust and improve. For example, recipes, we intentionally excluded them in the first few volumes, but it was obvious from response that the readers wanted to actually know how to do these things and cook the dishes that were in the photos. So we've changed and we'll now have recipes in it. From beginning to end, we consider how it is flipping through the pages. So if you flip from this painting to the next image, we make sure that the colors are consistent and flow together. And from essay to essay, are they connected? Are they cohesive? And we don't have any ad to editorial ratio that's pressured on us. So there's no ads in there to break up that flow.
How is it funded? Just by purchase price only?
Yeah. I mean, because we focus on that reading experience, I think that we can, I mean, we ask for a premium. So the cover price is a bit higher and that kind of allows us to be sustainable without the ads.
It's quite thick. How heavy is the magazine seems to be about a pound and a half almost,
isn't it? Yeah, it's 144 pages, 80-pound paper stock, so it's hefty.
It seems to have the feel of something that's, you know, organic or, you know, natural. Was there a care taken in that respect?
More for the aesthetic. I mean, we wanted it to feel organic, and it is kind of uncoated paper, and we do work with a responsible printer here in the U.S. out of Wisconsin to cut down on all the distribution costs instead of shipping it over from China.
Tell me about the dinner series.
Okay. So we recently kind of decided that dinners would be a great way to kind of extend what we're doing and actually walk the talk. So in the magazine, we talk a lot about community building and how it kind of strengthens our relationships by sharing meals and not just eating together, but actually cooking the meals together. So we started doing a dinner series, and every month we're in a different city, and we invite readers, and we engage and partner with local businesses, usually about 20 to 30 businesses, to put the event together. And it's a big dinner, and we set the table together, we meet each other, and it's been really a great experience to get out there. We kind of see Kinfolk as this marriage of our appreciation of art and design and our love for spending time with family and friends. So everything that we do, we have kind of a keen eye to the details and the design and the aesthetic to make sure that it feels beautiful, almost, I don't know, dreamlike, whimsical, but it's rooted in this community, this kind of lifestyle, spending time together.
And that was Nathan Williams, editor of Kinfolk, talking to Emily Young in Portland, Oregon. You're sitting there looking rather anxious at the edge of the table, Jen. I'm going to start with you. You've got different volumes that you were poring over before we went on air. What do you make of it?
I was a little bit puzzled by it, if I'm honest. I think it looks very appealing. But I'm somebody who does actually like to cook and make bread and knit and sew things and make things. And I was looking through it thinking sooner or later I'm going to get a recipe for something delicious.
Or something instructive.
Or something useful that I'm going to make something from. And in this version, I didn't find that, although I understand that that is something that they're developing, which does seem to me
makes sense.
A good idea.
I mean, from the outset, it's a pleasing looking title, I think, no question. I mean, quite interesting. This white strap they have across the top, you know, serif font, there's something very, very serene about the experience. But as you said, if you're someone who likes to knit and make things and make bread, where's the issue? Is it too precious? What's holding you back? Aside from there not being recipes and the ones you're looking at, but
I think it's that I would tend to read a specialist magazine like that maybe get inspiration. Well, in fact, definitely get inspiration. But then I want that to lead somewhere. And I also noticed that when they interview, there's a piece in the one I've got about a cookery school in Beaune in France, and it doesn't actually tell you how to get information about the cookery school. So there's no mention of the website or how much these courses might cost or anything like that. So presumably it's supposed to inspire you. I'm perhaps just a bit rushed for time as well. The bread making wouldn't make it sound like that, but I find these things as activities to do to relax at the end of a day. So I found that the fact it wasn't pointing you somewhere a little, well, it sort of, it gives you an idea and then it doesn't take you anywhere.
Mm. Zed, do you think it's trying to be deliberately analog? Just the fact that there, you know, I mean, there just seems to be, you know, a lack of sort of, you know, web addresses and things like that. And you know, Jane is saying it's maybe not pointing you in any direction, but it's almost a reaction to digital.
Well, it's a nice idea that it might be that. Yeah, I think maybe they just forgot, though, to put the important information in.
I thought that sort of Nathan sounded like a rather considered chap, though.
Yeah, no? True. I mean, well, I mean, look, it's beautifully designed and it is lovely looking. I find it, if I'm allowed to be negative, I suppose, dull, a bit boring. I flick through it and it's just very nice looking, but there's not a lot of context content that kind of grabs me. And if it was more informational, you know, as we talked about, if there were things to learn or recipes or whatever to follow, you know, you could gain that. But I think it might need more of that.
You know, this is a very expensive publication on the face of it, just from a production point of view. And as you said, you know, they print in Wisconsin to save on shipping costs. Nevertheless, there's no advertising in it. Can we see what the cover price is?
It's $18
US. So, okay, you know, I think that you can do all of the best maths in the world, but, you know, even, you know, doing the magazine that we do every month, $18 would not get you very far if we, you know, if we threw that on the cover of Monocle. I mean, it's, you really need the ad revenue. And I think it's very admirable what he's saying, that they don't get the pressure from advertisers. I think there's a different way of getting around that for sure. I'm not sure what you make of it when you look at sort of the editorial versus commercial component, how sustainable that is.
Well, I would. I'm not quite sure how it would do, to be honest, because $18, you have to sell an awful lot of copies at $18. I would have thought to pay for something like this. I think that, I mean, there's always issues around advertising. I think we would all love to sell, to not need them, in the sense that you had so many subscribers that you don't particularly need advertising. Although I must say, we know from the Art newspaper that a lot of our readers like looking at the adverts, because they're always for auction houses and things they might want to buy or exhibitions they want to go to. But I don't have any objection, obviously, to somebody trying to do something without advertising. I think it's it would be, most of us would find it a great relief if we didn't have to have it, and it was up to us as an add-on extra whether we wanted it or not. But it's not, of course, the reality that most of us face.
And I think you've given us an excellent cue. You're listening to The Stack. We're going away to a short commercial break. We're back right after this.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
Monocle Film stepped into the kitchen to watch Chef Jonathan Conroy prepare the perfect summer meal. A traditional Turkish starter, spaghetti vongole from the Med, and a quintessential British classic, the raspberry trifle, deliciously take shape on screen.
The fresh coriander is a really important thing. You have to be heavy-handed on that. Over-generous on the coriander. It's meant that every flavour should pack a punch.
Summer on a plate, on film, on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, Jane Morris, the editor of the Art newspaper, and photographer Zed Nelson. Now, I thought we would see what both of you brought in today. Zed, I you got to preview part of your stack, but I thought, Jane, why don't we start with you? You can move Kinfolk to one side now. You've got The Exhibitionist there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I thought that we might be worth looking at a couple of niche magazines of quite different sort of spectrums in the art world. And I've bought this one called The Exhibitionist, which is a curatorial magazine. It is edited by Jens Hoffmann, who sometimes contributes to the art newspaper, and he curates some of the events around Art Basel. And he's mostly, his full-time job is to be curator at the CCA Wattis in California, which is known for putting on quite experimental exhibitions. Mm. And the idea of this magazine is quite interesting, which is that they felt that there was no magazine for curators where they would write about things that interest them, whether or not they are timely. And this is interesting because they've got a mix of the timely, reviewing La Triennale in Paris. This came out in June. So this has come out only a couple of months after the Triennale, which by curatorial standards, that's a pretty fast turnaround. In fact, by art magazine standards, it's a pretty fast turnaround. But they've also got people talking about exhibitions that happened 10 years ago and indeed have dug up a piece by Harold Zeman. Zeman is one of the sort of famous curators that now dead, but is considered sort of founder of modern curatorship. And so they found a piece by him that's apparently has been long out of print, hard to get hold of, and they've republished that. You couldn't get more niche.
And we were talking about sort of, you know, numbers and business models. Where does this sit? If I went into, you know, a reputable gallery or, you know, or a museum, is this going to be on the top of someone's pile in the corner of their desk? Is this, you know, slightly porny bedside reading for people? You know, within your world, what space does it occupy?
I think you've got to be a fairly enthusiastic curator. I'm sure there's plenty of these dropping. I'm sure there's copies of these hanging around the Tate and places like that. It is very much for a small world of curators, although the contributors read like a who's who of the current sort of Biennale curators and up-and-coming people. And indeed, there is a piece in it by Adriana Pedroza, who is the curator, I believe, of Friesmaster's new spotlight section. Quite interesting, these people as well, because a lot of them are moving between the commercial world and the very not-at-all commercial world. So I would imagine its readership is small. You can buy it as a print edition. I think it's something like 20. I should ought to have this off the fingertips, and I don't. But I think it's something like $27 for two editions a year, or you could buy a PDF for $3. But what's interesting, I think, is that they didn't do it as an online publication. I'm not honestly sure why they didn't. But you know, but it's being sold in bookshops. I mean, you can buy this in the Tate bookshop. You can buy it in specialist art bookshops. Mm. So it'll get a reasonable circulation.
And from your perspective, someone would pick it up to be slightly annoyed if they are a curator at one institution because someone was able to sort of, you know, pen a fantastic piece and really sort of articulate the mission of what they wanted to do in this format, in case other people, you know, might have missed it. You know, the space that it occupies editorially.
I think it occupies a space where curators feel that nobody really writes and thinks about what they do in the way that they do it.
Right.
Most art criticism isn't like that. We could talk about the general issue. There is a general problem with art criticism. But I think that most of them would feel that the kind of reviewing that gets done in national newspapers, in the few that now do it with any seriousness, doesn't really address curatorship in the way that they think about it or the way they construct their exhibitions. So this is very much an internal world publication for... I mean, I would imagine it in your if Kinfolk is a cozy circle in the Hamptons somewhere or wherever it is. This is a cozy circle of about 50 curators who often work with each other, publishing things that are of interest to each other and probably criticising them behind their hands afterwards.
Zed, I don't know if you want to pick up on that or if you want to jump to that rather meaty volume you have from France or something else.
Yeah, I mean, this one, Simoir, the one I mentioned, is, I mean, it's beautifully produced. I mean, it really is like a book. Mm. And as I said, they do really kind of big in-depth stories on quite sort of interesting and varied subjects. Have you seen it before?
Yeah, and I just, if you pass it across, what's interesting is, you know, is this a forum where, you know, someone goes off and does an assignment, it is a bit of a, you know, it's something which is dear to someone's heart, and they know that they're going to get the 12 or 24 pages, but they'll also get 24 euros.
I think this one's actually more serious. They do, you know, they do pay for the content. You know, and I know as well, because I'm with an agency called Institute, and they represent a number of photographers. They, one of them, Paolo Woods, had a story in there for about, it's called China, Africa. And it looked at China's sort of influence and how they're really moving in economically into Africa. And it was just a really interesting, well-shot, thoughtful, interesting piece.
It's clever from a design point of view, because they're able to pull you in with these extended captions. I mean, they give you a slightly longer stand first than any, you know, that's a traditional magazine would have, because obviously, you know, you get into the introduction of the story. So I quite like the balance of course, you know, this very strong use of photography, but then enough extended captions in terms of explanation, which would be more than you would get at a Sunday supplement. True. Or if you were in a news weekly.
And what it isn't is a sort of sensational, a lot of magazines like that. Essentially, they're just kind of looking for amazing, sensational stories that stop you in their tracks. But this isn't. It's an intelligent, you know, thoughtful sort of, you know, magazine about all sorts of things.
And clearly takes, you know, photography very seriously, not just the, you know, the reproduction, but, I think the names that they're also commissioning as well. You mentioned an agency, and there was a very interesting piece, I think, in last week's edition of Business Week about Getty and the role that Getty Images plays, etc., and, you know, how they've really cornered the market when it, you know, certainly when it comes to, you know, if you want to upload something on your blog or if you want to print something in a brochure. And it talked about how, you know, traditional photo agencies are, you know, are very squeezed. And do you feel as a photographer today, you know, when people want the instant image that can be uploaded immediately, does that create, you know, greater value for someone like yourself and even the right type of agencies? You know, are they really sort of, you know, you talk about niche, are they really finding a niche in the market?
I'm not going to say the word niche in the next 5 minutes. No. I mean, that's going to give myself a test. Well, Getty are interesting. I mean, I once went, visited them, and I said, I actually described them like a sort of trawler, deep sea trawler that hoovered up the seabed. And they hoovered up all the photo agencies, and they hoovered up all the independent photographers. And now they sell images kind of like a supermarket, cut price, huge volumes. And their business model is mass sales for small amounts, which works for the company doing it, but doesn't work for the individuals necessarily linked to it. So what's happened now is most of the small agencies have gone out of business, and there's a few that have survived that have become very good, and they've survived because they've got vision and they've sort of, you know, really sorted themselves out using the kind of, in a way, the Magnum model. And that's sort of the landscape now. That's where we're at. And so, for instance, my agency will, you know, they'll just simply say, look, it costs this much to produce. If you want it, buy it. And if you don't, don't. And it's very difficult. We're at that very awkward stage now where a lot of magazines are run on such a sort of tight economic rein that sometimes, you know, you lose sales, or you just simply can't work with people because they won't pay. But that is a problem that I think everyone's facing.
Let's come back to the economics of things, because Jane, I see you nodding vigorously there as well about sort of the whole notion of what's happened with photo agencies and otherwise. And I think certainly, I think what's probably happened, you know, with many corners of the art world as well. I want to just introduce you to someone you might be familiar with him, but Mario Garcia. He's a frequent commentator, certainly here on Monocle 24, but is well respected around the world as probably, you know, the godfather of newspaper redesign. So if you have sagging Sunday sales, if your front pages aren't working anymore, you know, this man is constantly on a plane and is redesigning newspapers around the world. And we caught up with Mario a little bit earlier in our New York bureau.
Publishers are beginning to emerge from this period of deep meditation. Is print going to survive? And now they are going into this mood of course print is going to survive. But in order to survive, it will have to adapt and change.
If you're going to survive, you have to adapt and change. I'm going to go away to a break in a moment, and then we'll come back with a full piece of Mary and we can reflect on it right after this. And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where it's time to cross over to our bureau in New York now and catch up with Mario Garcia. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with Mr. Garcia, we go back some time, and I say we, not just as Monocle, but also just Tyler and Mario, back to the days of a program called The Desk that we were doing on BBC4, where, Mario, you really became something of a guru and commentator on that program about newspaper design. And, you know, if I look back, you know, at that program, you know, very much the rise of all things that were happening in terms of digital challenges to print. Right now, we're moving into the last quarter of 2012, Mario. I imagine a lot of U.S. media companies all over the world are really looking at their strategies, you know, towards 2013 right now. If you put yourself in the mind of a CEO, a managing director, a head of news for a magazine or a newspaper, what are the big challenges right now?
Well, I think that the first good news is, and your program called The Stack is so appropriate, because I do believe that The Stack is very much alive and people are reaching for The Stack. And in my own work right now, I'm involved with about three different projects in three different parts of the world where a new print publication will be created in 2013. So that stack will continue to get enriched by new publications. Publishers are beginning to emerge from this period of deep meditation. Where are we going? Is print going to survive? And now they are going into this mood of course print is going to survive. But in order to survive, it will have to adapt and change. And so the dialogue is different in different parts of the world. In parts of the United States, you're dealing with the frequency of publication. In other words, it's not about making print disappear, but is it better if we have a 3-time-a-week publication with a very robust weekend product, which really gives you the total lean back experience? Others are going into trimming the sizes of their newspapers to make them more compact. But I am beginning to see in my own work, in my own experience, that print is very much on top again, that print is the word, and that people are trying to take this platform that is print and adapt it to what I call the media quartet. Obviously, there is a smartphone, and then there is the online and the tablet. But there you have this print publication, which affords you the ultimate disconnect experience, the ultimate lean back experience. So I am seeing good things happening. And like I said, I'm in the process of creating three different publications, which are going to be born as part of a multi-platform environment. But nobody has said, oh, we will not do print with this new product. So that is good news.
Mm. I sometimes feel, Mary, that we're perhaps entering into a new age of reason, or at least that's what I've been calling it around the office, that there is a settle down now. There was a panic in boardrooms, on newsroom floors, but yes, this mad rush to only doing digital and everyone proclaiming the death of print, etc. But now things are maybe sort of leveling off. They're becoming a bit more rounded at the edges. And everyone, as you said, understands that there's, you know, for the very, you know, long foreseeable future, that there is definitely going to be a room for buying ink, for buying paper, making sure that you're certainly hedging against all of those things. Because, you know, all things and all media brands are not created equal, and different things have to punch it at different times. Why do you feel that we've come to this, you know, do you agree that we're in this age of reason now?
We definitely are into this age of reason. We are emerging from lamenting to celebrating. And I think that is what is so important and that makes me so proud. A person who's been in this business 41 years, I have ink in my blood. And I think that publishers have realized that these are the best times to tell stories, and we have the best stories to tell. And print provides an avenue to tell stories. For example, with photography, we are beginning to see that even though photo galleries do extremely well in digital platforms, there is nothing that compares to that photo that you can stare at and touch and so on, the contact with paper. The power of disconnect is very important. When you are reading your newspaper under a palm tree in Florida, you're not gonna get a beep. You're not gonna get a reminder that someone sent you a message on Facebook. I believe that kids who are in kindergarten and junior high school today are going to crave for moments of disconnect, and print provides that. But by the same token, when we are designing print right now, we know that a lot of our new audience will have a digital mentality. So what are the things we do when we design for print in 2013. Navigation has to be key. What you do so well in Monocle magazine, people are coming to print with this impatience that they have developed going using telephones and tablets and so on. But at the end of the day, they are going to lean back with this newspaper, this magazine, whatever it is in print, and they are going to sort of have a moment that is just me and my newspaper. And that is more difficult to have with a digital platform, which is you, me, the platform, and the rest of the world reaching for you.
Don't you think it's curious as well when you talk about this moment of being able to just settle in and relax and be disconnected? When you look at some of the better newsstands all over the world, in print, Mario, we've moved into a space which is almost more niche than ever. Of course, print costs have come down in many corners. You know, one can do very good work with digital print right now. So the barrier for entry has certainly dropped. And I think there's always been this very curious migration where we've seen so many niche blogs have actually now jumped off the backlit screen and have become magazines now. Is that almost a curious evolution? If we would have thought back a decade ago, who would have thought all of these blogs would suddenly now be twice yearly, three times a year magazines?
Absolutely. And this really goes back to my point that there is a migration from digital to print, not just of what you're talking about, columns that have started as blogs and have migrated. But there is a migration of people. I think you see it with The Economist. I see young people reading The Economist. Here in New York, you get on the subway. You see people in restaurants and so on having breakfast with a printed copy of The Economist. And these are 25, 26-year-olds who don't remember life without Google. So I think that there has been a migration to print. And the new publications that I am creating, in which case they're all newspapers, we are making sure that we make those printed publications attractive to this migration of people. We don't simply create a newspaper in 2013 to attract a 60-year-old who may not be into digital, because that is not the case. 75-year-olds have tablets. But we are trying to make sure that 28-year-olds, that 30-year-olds want to get their hands into this newspaper. And to be specific, without mentioning the real newspapers, one will be a Sunday-only product in one of the biggest countries in the world. Another one will be a financial newspaper in one of the troubled financial capitals of Europe. But they are going to be born as printed products that will provide what I call the mother's milk to the digital platforms around them. They will coexist in the media quartet, but the print will be the basis. And in every case, the CEOs of these newspapers never for a moment consider not having a print publication simply because they were creating this in 2013. So I think that you're having this program, The Stack, at this point. We are beginning to emerge into an era of reason, into an era of celebrating print for what it is, adapting it to the realities of today, but making it thrive.
And Mario, of course, you are going to leak those two publications when the moment is right. Of course, you'll be giving us the inside scoop of where those newspapers are going to be. Just before we go, as you know, you walk up to a newsstand right now, and the incredible thing is you're perhaps one of Lufthansa's more frequent flyers. You're looking at newsstands all over the world right now. What's exciting you when you're just pure free time? Of course, you're always working, but you want to just lie back on your flight crossing the Pacific or the Atlantic. What are you looking at right now and saying, this is smart, this inspires me, and this is something that I really want to spend 30 minutes, 45 minutes with, 2 hours with?
Well, I am, to be honest with you, I am totally addicted to The Economist, and I find it that it's not just downtime, and I need this magazine. The content of this magazine is very necessary to me. I actually crave it, and when I get it, I read it basically from cover to cover. It's just the way they write their headlines, the way they treat news. That, you know, part of the secret for print, Tyler, is that they have to deal with reaffirmation in a way that makes you take the news that you already know and not just see a rehash of it, but they really take it to the next level. The Economist does that with their headlines. So this is one publication that I always take a look at. Obviously, and I'm very happy to see it now on my Lufthansa flights as well, Monocle is a magazine that I always carry with me. I always learn tremendously about cities that I'm going to, about trends, not just about the media, but things in general. That's another one that I like. I'm more disappointed by the American magazines, to be honest with you. I think that I subscribe to Time Magazine, to Newsweek. I believe that these magazines need to actually step into the celebration period that we're talking about and redefine themselves. Yes, we've had a glorious past, but this is now, and really move into, again, how can you present the news that I already know and make me believe that it's necessary that I read you, because you're going to give me a little bit more of a contemplative mode in it. I was telling the editor of a very large American newspaper, an iconic newspaper, 2 days ago, that the Sunday edition of this newspaper is going in the right direction because it is becoming more didactic. American newspapers abandoned their didactic role. Latin American newspapers never have abandoned that, or for that matter, El País of Madrid. You get a Sunday edition of El País or La Nación of Buenos Aires, and you get totally immersed into literature, into culture, into things that are remote from news, but they really are what good, robust weekend newspapers should be all about. You get it in Germany with the Zeit. I mean, these are newspapers that are going to make you feel like you need to dive into this. For me, the survival of print is to really become more didactic. Newspapers in the 19th century used to do that. In Latin America, it's not unheard of that one of the newspapers will have the first chapter of a Mario Vargas Llosa novel on paper. American newspapers stopped a long time ago devoting ink and paper to such endeavors. And I believe that the survival of weekend newspapers specifically is going to be assuming a different role and not just going after the five W's and the H, because obviously news now breaks on Twitter and the digital does that very well. You're gonna have to educate me. You're gonna have to seduce me by telling me I need this information. I will be a better conversationalist. I will be a better thinker. I will vote better in the next election because of information you have provided. And I think that that is a more expensive journalism to do, but there is no choice. For people in print, specifically newspapers and magazines, they have to go that route. The goals are lofty, the goals are tremendously, the bar is very high, but that is what will, I think, will make print emerge triumphant and what will make print stand out in this media quartet as needed, and allowing you to really kick off your shoes, lie down by the fireplace, by the beach, and be totally immersed and educated by the offerings in a printed newspaper or magazine.
Mario Garcia, you've made some people in Buenos Aires and Hamburg and Madrid, but also at the Economist headquarters in St. James and here at Midori House at Monoclitch, you're very, very happy. We look forward to chatting to you every week over the weeks to come here on The Stack. Mario Garcia at our bureau in New York, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Stack. We're in London. We're back right after this.
The designers at J. Crew are constantly experimenting with new styles, but it's their staples that they're most proud of. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchens explains, J. Crew's unique approach to tailored clothing led to the now iconic Ludlow suit, recognized for its superior construction and smart bespoke details.
I love it when people start to recognize garments by the way they are cut. It gives it its own personality, and I think that's what we're looking for. And for instance, the Ludlow jacket has a specific narrow lapel. It's narrow, but not too narrow. It has a really nice soft shoulder. It has a shoulder pad in it, but just ever so subtly. And I think there's the Ludlow jacket is so great. I think there's about 200 steps it takes to make a Ludlow jacket. People maybe sometimes don't realize what it takes to come to this kind of product.
J. Crew.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25/25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle. keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, Zed Nelson, and Jane Morris. I just wanted to reflect on that piece that we were listening to Mario a bit earlier. You talked about this whole, you know, lean back moment that we're in. You talked about this whole sense of that newspapers need to be more didactic. And you talked about this. It's quite interesting how he talks about a celebration period that U.S. news magazines and newspapers need to embrace that. What did you think about his take on a prescription, you know, where so many people think that this is, you know, we absolutely cannot be in a business of dailies or even weekend papers anymore, Jane?
I thought what he had to say was fascinating because we've actually been thinking about some of this ourselves, as I think everybody does periodically when they work on a paper or what, or a magazine. And as part of that, I you can order old newspapers. So I went and ordered a Guardian from 2001 because they used to do a cultural review section on Saturday that I particularly loved. It only lasted for a few, you know, maybe 3-4 years. And it was fascinating to see that Guardian come through the post because they come absolutely as they, you know, as they were. So it's the whole thing. And if you compared that Saturday Guardian of 10 years ago with the Saturday Guardian today, you would probably understand why most of us in the art world loved the Guardian at one time, and now, to be honest, have somewhat lost interest in it. It was packed full of literature, of really good articles about the arts. The news pieces were very good because they had a lot of background information. So what I thought when he was talking about didactic, I thought, yes, I used to sit down on a Saturday and feel like the Guardian had given me a really big insight into world news, into culture, into business, into everything, and that I had sort of caught up with everything and enjoyed doing it, particularly in fields I didn't really know much about. And I don't think the papers are doing that now. And I think that if I were publishing a mass market publication, mass newspaper, well, publishing a not mass market newspaper, I think that issue about how do we educate people, how do we make people feel really involved and stretched into things that might interest them is a big part of what we should be doing.
Zed, reflections on what he was saying. I mean, aside from didactic, Nate, just during the break, you were talking about just tell me something I don't know. I mean, just give me something which is truly, not breaking news as a surprise, but that sense of the unexpected.
Well, I mean, I thought he was brilliant. I really enjoyed listening to him. And, you know, the things he talked about, finding unexpected things in a magazine, to me, is something that really struck me while I was researching magazines yesterday. And I suddenly realised that, you know, I want a magazine that's fairly broad interest. I want them to, I don't want it to be sort of too familiar and know where it's going. And occasionally they just deliver something that you had nothing, you didn't even know you were interested in that subject. And it's, you know, you're suddenly in that world. So I do think that's utterly important. His sort of discussion about, you know, his phrase, moments of disconnect, that was really interesting as well. I find myself craving those moments. And I think that's the beauty of print. And that, exactly as he said, is, you know, is its strength, and magazines need to understand that.
Obviously, you know, Jane, you're an editor. You've got publishers, and you know, maybe you have to go and talk to board once in a while. Maybe you don't. I mean, I know I certainly do. You know, is it that understanding about that sense of disconnect and the power that paper has, and you know, and whether the power that paper has to sell advertising and be persuasive as much as it is, as allows images to lift off the page. You know, when you and I'm not just what happens within your own boardrooms, but when you're talking to your peer set right now as well.
I think that some people do really understand that. I think that print does give people, well, it does give something authority. It's, as we've been discussing, it's great for very busy people just to be able to sit away from their computer and the noise and so forth and actually just enjoy it and read it. I think that publishers, though, need to think about this, because what tends to happen is that people feel that they are getting older, that they're behind the times, that because they're 50, everybody at 20 is really different from them. And thus, the way we consume the media is changing so rapidly that we must all be thinking about digital only. And yet, I think most people's sales and advertisers would indicate that actually the print publication is really important.
Yeah, it was interesting when he talked about sort of, Mary talked about the mother's milk, that the print edition is still the mother's milk. I thought that was fascinating. His reference, I think, was editorial, but I think from a business point of view as well. You know, as successful as the New York Times is, and you know, we hear about it all the time digitally, it wouldn't be the success story it is today if it did not have that daily edition there. We don't have too much more time. You've got art form in front of you, and I'm wondering where that sits in sort of the hierarchy and strata of print for you.
Well, I think this is an interesting one because I think that almost everybody in the art world reads Art Forum, whether they like it or not. We all look at it.
Headquartered where?
New York. New York, founded in, I think, Los Angeles or San Francisco. Los Angeles, I think, it's 50 years this year. And the next edition is the 50th edition, but it moved to New York in the 60s. And it has an editorial board on it that's another who's who, even more so than the exhibitionist. So Hans-Ulrich Obrist, I believe, is on there. But certainly Daniel Birnbaum is on there. The philosopher Arthur Danto is on there. Thomas Crowe, all kinds of major figures are on its editorial board. And yet, it's actually rather an awkward magazine. It's interesting because I've been looking at it compared with some of the newer magazines, which, you know, we've been looking at these sort of £15, $18 sort of magazines. Art Forum has always gone for it's $10. It's the weight of a brick. It's posted to you. So they must spend nearly all of that on the postage. It's got a circulation of about 60,000, which is a lot for a magazine like this. You can't actually find much in it because it's so stuffed with adverts. So it's the sense of the unexpected comes when you manage to find one of the articles. But the good thing with Art Forum is when you find the articles, they usually are worth reading. They are written by people who write very well, curators, academics, and very good journalists. So when you get between the great raft of advertising, which you won't be able to see because we're on radio, but you get runs of 20 or 30 pages of advertising.
I was going to say, it almost looks like it's 60% commercial, 40% editorial, even less maybe.
It's massively ad heavy. The interesting thing, of course, is that everyone reads the adverts because it tells you what shows are on, it tells you who's opening a new gallery, it tells you who's representing somebody different.
So a title where you would not get readers complaining about the ads, probably.
One or two. They do.
But you'll always get readers like that.
But inside the art world, who are actually in it, we tend to look at the ads too.
Zed, I'm going to give you one title to talk about in full or two to talk about in half before we go. What do you have?
There's a photography magazine here to follow the theme of what we are discussing, British Journal of Photography, BJP. It used to be a really not very attractive, not very good magazine, and they redesigned it, and the same people are still working there, so it wasn't a sort of sell-off, and they completely revamped it, and now it's a really good magazine.
That's why Mario Garcia is so successful. You see, design can save everything.
And I mean, they put the price up.
Was it just saved by design, do you think? You know, I'm not sure if it's a title that you read, but you also feel even the same editors are there. It's just been, you know, the savior has been new typography and a new grid.
It's not just that. They kind of woke up and smelt some form of coffee. It also, they looked at more sort of art photography. It became less industry focused. I've got a story in there, actually, about Hackney. I've just done a big project about my home borough. And so it was
this is not just the reason why we're plugging it today.
No, not at all. And it was a combination of a redesign and a sort of ideological shift, you know, right. And it worked. And I think that's a good lesson.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. There is so much more to get through. We've got copies of Baumeister and Green Soccer Journal, but that is almost a full hour on the clock here on the stack on Monocle 24. Zed Nelson and Jane Morris, thank you very much for that. Our producers today were Don Trump and Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Ben Jay. Of course, if you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. here in London. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Berlay, it's goodbye from London.